Welcome to The Civilist from WUNC and PRI. It's a podcast about how to talk and listen respectfully about the things that matter. I'm your host, Stephen Petro. On today's episode, MIT sociologist Sherry Turkle is here. She'll tell us why smartphones are really bad for real-life conversation.
The phone reminds us of all the other elsewheres we can be, and it takes us away.
She also says that young people are growing up with impaired empathy. Well, we'll see what our undergraduate experts have to say about that. Two college students join us in the studio to take your questions about the digital generation gap, political correctness, and what are called safe spaces on campus.
So if you want to levy a valid critique about a sensitive issue, that's one thing. But if you want to draw on old stereotypes to make a non-point, then that's not the space for that.
All that is right ahead on The Civilist Podcast. And now to our deeper dive. Today I'll talk with renowned media scholar and MIT professor Sherry Turkle. She is also the author most recently of Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age. In my weekly USA Today column called Digital Life, I often find myself advising readers to keep their phones off the dinner table and out of the bedroom. And so many of my columns end with some form of this admonition: use your words. And by that I mean really communicate with each other. Put simply, Sherry Turkle is a woman after my own heart. It's her position that the promises of technology blind us to their consequences, and they lead us to sacrifices we can hardly fathom. Missed opportunities to talk to and connect with each other, unprecedented political rifts, and loneliness. Sherry, welcome to The Civilist Podcast. I know we've been coordinating over email, but it's great to actually speak to you. And I promise you that I have left my phone outside of the studio. I'd like to know where yours is.
Actually, my phone is turned off and is deeply hidden from me. So you did better. You did better.
I was afraid.
I know.
So I want to start a little bit personally with you. And by that, maybe you can talk to us about what your personal rules are for including, excluding digital devices in your life. You know, what's your operating procedure?
Well, you know, I sort of have found myself following the research. Because one of the most stunning pieces of research is one you just alluded to, that a phone on a lunch table will do two things to the conversation. Even a silent phone will cause the conversation to go to trivial matters, and it will cause the two participants at lunch to feel less of an empathic connection to each other. So whenever I'm with a friend or with a family member, I never have a phone out, ever. The phone reminds us of all the other elsewheres we can be, and it takes us away.
Well, I will tell you, one of the changes I've made in the last year, and it really was at the begging of my husband, which was to keep the phone out of the bedroom for the very, very same reasons that you say, because... You know, I would check it in the middle of the night. I would get involved in something. I also found that I started to sleep so much better by not being interrupted by myself or by my device.
Right. You know, there is something else that, you know, educators should start to think about, is that for most purposes, other than when you're acting truly with intention, it's much better if students put away their phones, their laptops, and their tablets during class and take notes by hand. It turns out that taking notes by hand is really a better way for students to integrate the material. An open laptop creates a kind of circle of attentional disarray around the open laptop. Because people are distracted and students don't want to be. It's almost not their fault. They want to Google something that's completely relevant to the course. And then because there are ads that correspond to their interests and because they've already registered their credit card, let's say on PayPal or something, all they have to do is click a button and they're buying something. And they are buying. They are shopping. They are on Facebook during class time. And it's much easier to just say no laptops and no tablets in class. Let them pay attention.
Let me go back up to 30,000 feet here and ask you, why is talking so important? Because I think that's really the major claim of this book, Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk. I have three nieces. They're all teenagers. They chat amongst themselves, but they don't talk.
Right. Well, there's a certain kind of talk. There's a kind of talk where you let yourself go off on a tangent, where you're doing it face-to-face, where you allow really a conversation to happen, where you reveal yourself, where you allow silences. And one person said that they really didn't like doing that. And I said, well, what's wrong with conversation? And he said to me, it takes place in real time, and you can't control what you're going to say. And maybe that's the best answer to your question about what's right with talk, is to hear what people are avoiding when they don't want to do talk. Is that you reveal yourself, you learn what you're thinking as you say it, you're unedited. And we're dealing with a generation that's grown up with the edited life. You edit your Facebook profile, you can edit what you say online, you get to present yourself as you want to be. And talk is where you are much more vulnerable. It's a much more vulnerable way of being.
You know, I love vulnerability up to a point, and I like controlled vulnerability too. So I see it both ways.
Well, my point is there's a place for both.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the logic of technology is too often that we go for replacement rather than respect for both.
Mm-hmm. But here's yes. my question for younger people. You know, they have grown up not in the habit of talking, whether it's on phones or face-to-face. And so in a sense, they're not reclaiming anything. And, you know, they're not at a loss for remembering because it's not part of their experience. So what do we do with that generation?
Well, Reclaiming Conversation is really a plea for mentorship. It's very often parents who have been smitten with their devices themselves and have not talked to their kids. I mean, it's parents who are buying baby bouncers that have a slot for an iPhone or an iPad. I mean, this is technology making us forget what we know about life, which is that toddlers need your face, they need your conversation, they need your eye contact. So I think that what children need is for us to remember to start to talk to them. I interviewed so many 11, 12, 13, 14-year-olds who say, I have never taken a walk with my father when he didn't have his phone with him and took calls along the way. Now, first of all, that's a child who has never experienced the kind of conversation I'm talking about, where you're not interrupted, where you have silences that aren't filled, where you learn the importance of boredom. One of the arguments in my book is that children need to learn how to be bored, how to let their minds wander, how to be alone, how to enjoy solitude. You know, I'm basically saying, when you say to me, well, what can we do, is it's not too late to put away the phone, look up, and start the conversation. We have everything we need to start. We have each other. And so I think that I really am calling for a kind of deep breath and saying, look, we really should not go on this way, because we're losing things that we really hold dear. And we just have moved unreflectively into a way of life that we are starting to regret.
Our reliance on digital devices only seems to be getting worse these days, and I'd be lying if I didn't get awfully down about it. So where are you on the spectrum between optimism and pessimism, Sherry? Because I see you wearing an optimist's hat.
Well, my reading of the situation is that if we go on as we're going on, we're going to be in very significant trouble. There's a study that showed that college students, after 6 minutes of just being allowed to sit with their own thoughts, would rather give themselves electroshocks than just sit quietly without a phone or a book.
Yikes.
I mean, yeah, yikes.
Yikes.
I mean,
it's kind of ouch.
Yeah, ouch. I mean, that this is not good, that we're losing these crucial capacities. That my students can't make eye contact with me. So I'm not so much optimistic as I am activist.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that we're at a point where both in business and in education and in our family life, we're starting to see the costs. We've had experience with the technology. We know what to say to designers to begin to design technology that will serve our needs better. And it's time to make those first steps to make it suit us better.
Sherry Turkle is a sociologist at MIT. Her latest book is Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age. It's been recently published in paperback. She joined me from Marketplace Studios in Los Angeles. Thanks so much, Sherry.
My pleasure.
And now for a new edition of New Rules for Better Behavior. In this segment, my guest experts and I take your toughest social quandaries and come up with solutions you can use. Today, I've invited two kick-ass undergrads to answer questions that came from their peers about college life, free speech, trigger warnings, and more. First, we have Chinyere Amanzi from my alma mater, Duke University in Durham. She's a senior, and her major is International Comparative Studies with a focus on Africa. You go by Chi-Chi, so welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And from down the tobacco road, as we say, we have a senior from our NCAA rival in basketball, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Monique Laborde, your double major in gender and Southern studies. And thanks for being here, Monique.
Thank you.
So we all just listened to MIT's Sherry Turkle talk about how social media and smartphone use affects real life relationships. She says the partial anonymity and the constant distraction is making young people less empathetic, not to mention unable to discuss political issues with a sense of give and take, or what I like to call civility. So, Chi-Chi, do you think that your peers are less empathetic than, say, Turkle's baby boomers, people like me?
I honestly don't think so, Stephen. I think no matter what generation you're in, you're going to have distractions. The baby boomers had their own distractions, even if it wasn't Twitter and their handheld iPhone. And I think, honestly, I think social media in some ways enhances empathy. I've seen a lot of instances in which social issues have been discussed or students have expressed hard times they're going through with mental health or family struggles on social media because partly of the kind of anonymity and being able to just put your feelings out there, and seen a lot of really empathetic and caring responses. So I don't think Turkle quite hit it on the nail on the head.
Well said. And Monique, do you think technology and social media have impacted political discourse among your peers?
I do think technology and social media have exposed people to new ideas and new perspectives, and also perhaps jaded people because they see social media fights and they disagree with people on social media and get entrenched in their own ideas. But I don't think that it has necessarily caused the problem of political polarization. It's maybe just been a mirror for us to see the problem better.
Yeah, I always think we kind of rush to blame technology when usually the problem of behavior resides inside of each of us, but neither of you. So let's take some listener questions. The first comes from a guy who doesn't want anyone to keep him from speaking up or out.
Hi, Stephen. I've noticed some clubs and professors at my school are setting up safe spaces for certain events. One of my professors also puts trigger warnings on assignments. I don't get why these things are necessary. To me, college is a time to learn. The real world doesn't give trigger warnings. I feel like the whole thing is trying to limit free speech and force everyone to be politically correct. And I want to say something when this comes up, but what do I say?
Well, I think that's a very timely question from what I understand of what's happening on campuses everywhere. Let me give a couple of definitions before we jump in here. So a safe space is somewhere college students can come together and not worry about being targeted for their race, sexual orientation, or gender. And a trigger warning lets students know that a book, an article, a film contains language or images that could set off a past trauma. For instance, a book passage about sexual assault might come with a trigger warning so that those who have been victims of rape or an assault can opt out of the assignment. So Monique, let me turn to you first. You're a proponent of safe spaces and trigger warnings, right?
Yes.
So why are they important?
I think the way the listener was describing, he didn't understand why they were necessary. It seems necessary for people who have experienced the trauma that the trigger warning is trying to protect against, and people who maybe know someone or are members of a group that feels a collective trauma. Those people understand why a trigger warning is there. And I think that the university is not necessarily the real world. It is a place for us to learn and to process how the world works before we go into the world. That's why we're paying to go to university. And so I think that it's fair for professors and leaders in that environment to say to people, especially because trigger warnings usually target people who have had marginalized experiences or experienced trauma personally, to say that the content that they're about to propose or we're about to study in class is going to impact their psyche specifically more than it might impact someone else's.
Could you give us an example of a trigger warning you've encountered in your time at Chapel Hill?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I took a class called The Prophetic Tradition, but it was a lot about religious rights and racial rights in the U.S., and there was a lot of talk of violence and persecution of religious minorities and racial minorities, and the professor would, before he would show a violent video that was a scene of warfare in, you know, Israel, for example, he would tell the class, we're about to watch this. If this makes you uncomfortable, you can opt out. And in my experience, everyone stayed in the class, but he just said it.
So they have that option.
They have the option to stay, of course.
So Chichi, let me turn to you on this.
Mm-hmm.
The American Association of University Professors has been critical of both trigger warnings and safe spaces. And they've written, this is a quote, "The presumption that students need to be protected rather than challenged in a classroom is at once infantilizing and anti-intellectual." I'm wondering what you think about that. And do you think that especially trigger warnings can deter free speech?
Well, Stephen, I honestly don't think so. I think trigger warnings and safe spaces are not spaces without discourse. Like, there are still spaces where you can share ideas, where you can express your beliefs, but there are also spaces where you cannot express offensive beliefs without any founding. So if you want to levy a valid critique about a sensitive issue, that's one thing. But if you want to kind of draw on old stereotypes to make a non-point, then that's not the space for that. And so I don't think that that's infantilizing. I honestly think that's encouraging students to make more solid arguments and to not draw back on some of our natural biases and prejudices to make paperman arguments, but to actually come with something to contribute to the space.
And Monique, did you have something to say to that?
I did. I was also thinking, I loved how you said it encourages students to think more broadly, but it encourages students to be aware of other people's perspectives in the class. By saying there's a trigger warning, you in the class are aware that someone else might have lived an experience similar to that in a way that you were not if the trigger warning was not said.
So when I first heard about trigger warnings and safe spaces a couple of years ago, they were concepts that were new to me and very different from the experience that I had in college. And so I would say, vastly unfamiliar. But as I've talked to other students, as I have, I guess, lurked on Yik Yak when I've been on campuses and seen the kind of anonymous vitriol that is directed, you know, at individuals with really no recourse that can be 24/7, when literally there is no safe space to go, I've begun to understand why there's a need for safe spaces like that, not just as a metaphor, but as a literal space. So I really appreciate you helping to explain this, because I think for those of us who are not familiar with the language and the terms, it really helps to sort of make them real. So why don't we move on to the next question? And our caller is a music lover.
Hey, Stephen. So I love hip hop, but I'm white. I would never use racial slurs in real life, but is it okay to sing along with rap lyrics if they're using the N-word or something? What if I'm just with other white people? I'm glad this is anonymous. Thank you.
So this question touches on a number of issues, including what's called cultural appropriation, and that's the adoption or use of elements of one culture by members of another culture. But it's also an issue of racial sensitivity. So Chinyere, we'll start off with you on this one. Is it appropriate for white people to sing along with rap lyrics like this? And what about if the person's intention is actually good?
So as an African-American woman, I can definitely appreciate
the complication in this question, and I thank the viewer for asking. And I understand that it can be complicated, especially when you have artists, Black artists, using the N-word in their music, encouraging their fans to sing along at concerts or in person. But I still think that we should err on the side of courtesy and of respect, and not use such a derogatory slur that doesn't apply to you. And I think that's important because the N-word does not just exist in rap music or in things that are like quote-unquote fun. It still carries a very sensitive and a very painful history, and it's still used as a derogatory slur today. And we see that all the time in Twitter comments or YouTube comments against Black Americans, especially well-known Black Americans. So I think acknowledging that that history is still alive and that that word is still regularly used as a derogatory slur, I would suggest that white people stay away from it.
Mm-hmm. And Monique, do you see examples of this kind of appropriation on campus or other kinds? And, you know, what's your take?
Oh, I definitely see cultural appropriation on campus, especially with appropriation of African-American culture. Fraternities often play rap music at parties. And it does seem problematic because fraternities have a history of being exclusive, you know, only including white people.
Many of them.
Well, historically white fraternities, right?
Yeah, historically white.
Mm-hmm. And I think that that's only one example of the kinds of cultural appropriation that go on. I think there's a societal sort of epidemic of a cultural appropriation of Black culture and naming it everyone's culture without really naming who did the creating.
And I agree with both of you on this one that I don't think that white people should be using singing these lyrics. And I was actually going to pull up an example that that came from my identity as an LGBT person, because a lot of times people in my community use language like dyke, like other words, within our group. But those who are outside, they hear it and they begin to think, well, if I'm using it or a lesbian friend of mine is using it, then, well, that's fine for me to use too. So I think we have a little bit of responsibility to be careful about the kind of language within a group that we use that is heard outside of that group. And for those who are on the outside, I think they should always remember, do not use language that is really part of a group, part of the vernacular that belongs to it, because you will step into something that you didn't mean to, even if you do have a good heart. So let's move on to the final question, and that comes from a frustrated millennial, which the two of you are. Not frustrated, but you're millennials.
Hey, Stephen. I'm over old people in the media whining about millennials. They're always talking about how lazy, entitled, and narcissistic we are. I mean, it's totally ridiculous when you think about how we were raised, you know, to reach for the best opportunities. Anyway, the economy fell apart, and these baby boomers are still in their jobs, and that means I don't have one. It's not my fault that the economy is the way that it is, or that jobs are as bad as they are. But I need a good comeback whenever some old person tries to lump me in together with all the rest of the millennials, you know, like we're a bunch of degenerates. Anyways, what do you think I should say?
Well, I'm just going to start here and say calling folks old people is not a great way to start your question. And more seriously, ageism is much of an ism as many of the others that we talk about. But Monique, let me ask you this. How do you feel about being called a millennial? Do these labels serve any purpose? And what do you think about this fellow?
I do not stray away from being called a millennial, just like any other social category. You know, I identify as a white woman, a millennial, LGBTQ. But what I do stray away from is when people universalize the group or try to make some universal quality, like, you know, all women should do this, or all millennials are lazy and always on their phone and bad at communication, like Turkle, our first woman. I got a little hint of that from her when she was saying, oh, these millennials are bad at empathetic communication. I was like, well, maybe we're good at it and good at also technological communication. Like, we can be good at both. And I do think because we've grown up with both in-person communication and communication over technology, we're more versatile and we have the opportunity to like switch between the two modes, which are going to be required in our futures.
So Chichi, what do you think about people who stereotype you as part of this millennial generation?
I was actually so glad this question came up, Stephen, because I just had this experience on campus.
speaking with an older member of the Duke community, but
an older member.
That's anyone over
35 these days.
I was gonna say 25.
But I honestly, if someone were to group me with the millennials, I think a good response comes out of three ways. One, like Monique was saying, I think she made a really good point that lumping any large group of people together and putting one label on them, you're likely not going to be accurate. You're not really going to be hitting the nail on the head. So if you find yourself lumping one group together, whether it's women or millennials, maybe take a step back and say, all million something of these people cannot be the same. Second, I would kind of draw on this trend of generational differences. I know my parents have their thoughts about millennials, but I know my grandparents had their thoughts about my parents' generation. And that's just a regular trend of kind of the generation before seeing the generation after and being like, what are y'all doing?
So what should people do when they encounter that attitude?
In my experience, when I've encountered it, I just kind of address it if it's really important. And I think there's strong arguments to be made. There's a lot of research online about the millennial generation, the kind of economic situation we're facing with the job market, with the skyrocketing cost of a college education, about how millennials are using technology, sure, to go on Twitter and Facebook, but also to do great things and to be empathetic on Twitter and Facebook. So I always like to have my facts with me to back me up when someone's like, well, you millennials are lazy and entitled. I'm like, well, actually, we're doing big things.
I think facts are a really good basis for everything. And speaking of facts, I'm going to address one part of the question that's really not about civility, but it's not my fault he asked that the economy is the way it is. Well, the economy is a lot better now than perhaps when people graduated 4 or 8 years ago. So let's note that. And then, you know, he asked for a good comeback. And in my role as an advice giver, I often get asked for a good comeback for a variety of situations. And that is always meant to be, can you help me be mean to somebody? Mm-hmm. And so my answer is always, no, I don't have a good comeback for you. Address the situation with your words and with your heart. Well, Shaneri and Monique, thank you both for coming in today and giving us your millennial advice. I think it transcends your generation.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Shaneri Amanzi is an International Comparative Studies major at Duke University, and Monique Laborde is a double major in Gender and Southern Studies at UNC Chapel Hill. Need some really good advice from my guest experts? Record a voice memo of your question and email it to thecivilistpodcast@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 919-263-0929. You can also submit questions or any comments really on the PRI app. It's available for iOS and Android. Just use the handy-dandy voice memo feature for The Civilist. And that's our show. If you like what you hear, please subscribe. And while you're at it, would you consider leaving a 5-star review on iTunes? The Civilist Podcast is a production of WUNC, PRI, and myself. My producer is Rebecca Martinez. Mark Blasco wrote our theme song. Special thanks to Hadi Mawagdi, Alice Chung, and Will Michaels. I'm Stephen Petro. Thanks for listening.